Oh, good afternoon. Let's call the meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is currently 1:37 p.m. Thursday, February 18th. Currently, we have Senator Bishop here, as well as myself, Chairman Myers. We do not have a quorum, but we should have a quorum later once we get to the bill in question. Staffing the committee today, we have Nancy Hemingway from Senate Records, Alec Banasek is our moderator, and Michaela Anderson is my committee aide. And if everybody could please turn their cell phones off. Business for today, we will be doing an overview on statewide aviation and international airports from DOT. Presenting will be John Binder, the Deputy Commissioner. After that, we will be hearing Senate Joint Resolution Number 9, urgent exemption for cruise ships. At this point, I'll turn the floor over to Deputy Commissioner Binder for the overview. If you could identify yourself for the record. And in between slides, if you could just do a quick pause to see if we've got any questions, and if we could make sure we keep up a decent pace, because we do have one other piece of business on the agenda today. But with that, take it away, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Binder, Deputy Commissioner with Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And Andy will be running the slides for me, Andy Mills with DOT. Next slide. The department's mission is obviously to keep Alaska moving through service and infrastructure. On the aviation side, we do consider two big chunks there under the department. One's the Alaska International Airport System, often referred to as AIAS, and statewide aviation, which is really everything else DOT owns, so everything except Anchorage and Fairbanks International. Both those have their own primary focuses there under their missions, and we've certainly seen both of those come to light this year with the challenges we face in 2020. Next slide.
If we could just real quick for the record note that Senator Schauer has joined us.
Thanks, sir.
Continue, please.
This org chart just kind of shows my area of responsibility there, in addition to a couple of the things within the department, but aviation does tend to dominate most of my time. Really what I want to highlight on this is, although the international system lies within DOT and under DOT's budget, the international system does not utilize any state funds, and no revenue from the international system flows to the state as well. They are self-sustaining per statute. Next slide. Slide. And just a little bit more on the international structure. Again, it was created by statute there quite some time ago. They do work together as a system there, so we try to keep things coordinated and united between them, keep as similar as possible. We do operate their budget through a rates and fees structure that charges tenants, airlines, concessionaires, everybody that uses those two airports. Their rates and fees completely fund the airport, both the operation on the capital side. Next slide. We're currently under an operating agreement, a 10-year agreement that will expire in 23. That agreement is specifically with airlines that sign on to that agreement. They are considered signatory carriers. For the last several years, we've averaged around 29 to 30 carriers. With the huge increase in cargo this year, we've had several Asian carriers sign on to that agreement as well. What being a signatory gets you, as far as that agreement goes, is one, it gives you a lot more say into how the airport utilizes its funds, both operating and capital. We have to receive airline approval for any larger expenditures. In addition, for bearing some of that risk and responsibility, signatory carriers do get a slightly reduced rates on landing fees, rental fees, those sorts of things. On the flip side, I mentioned the risk. They also sign on that since we calculate our rates and fees based on what our expected costs are for the coming year, when we get to the end of that year, if we have made more than we needed, then that bonus, that surplus, just rolls into the next year's calculations and allows us to reduce rates. However, if we end up a little bit short, the agreement allows us to go back then and back bill each of those carriers based on the amount of their activity to make us whole, so that we finish the year on budget. And the last piece I'll throw out is the system does have the authority to issue bonds itself, specific airport revenue bonds, for large capital type projects. We have not issued bonds in many years, but that is always an option available.
We got a quick question from Senator Schauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Never know if it's a quick question or not, but it's a question. So one of the things that I paid attention to, because this is kind of up my lane, flying out of there for a cargo carrier on my other day job, is what we used to, when we had the North Pole refinery open, we shipped a lot. I don't know if it was most, although I believe it was, of the jet fuel from that refinery. And, of course, there was a tax base that supported, you know, with revenue to the state, airport, et cetera. That has, of course, gone away, and I understand that most of it is, you know, either we don't have the capacity to support that level of fuel from the two smaller refineries that we operate in-state roughly, but can you just illuminate for us where most of the fuel is coming from and what that's done from a revenue perspective to us? Because it has been a pretty significant impact, as I understand it. And I think a lot of people don't realize what not refining our own oil has done to us in that perspective, and the loss of revenue and how that's gone. And even to the effect, I heard one carrier was actually shipping refined fuel from Taiwan based on cost. So can you, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, just speak to that, because it's been a pretty significant issue. I don't want to overstate it, but I think it's something that might be good for to get on the public record, if you don't mind.
Absolutely, Senator Schauer, through the chair. A couple key pieces on that. One, of course, the international system does not buy, sell, serve anything having to do with fuel. We do have a tank farm on the airport, but it is a fuel consortium that is run, and members, airlines are the members of that consortium, and they completely control and run that tank farm and how that fuel is distributed throughout the airport. That said, you are correct that in the past, a larger percentage of the jet fuel did come from in-state. We do have a pipeline connected directly to Nikiski that comes to the airport, and we also have a pipeline that connects us to the port. So that is how the fuel actually gets to the airport to be put into those tanks. As far as purchasing, most of those carriers, especially the large ones that buy a significant amount of fuel, are able to get better prices for their bulk purchases on the international market. So most of the jet fuel that is used at the airport is barged in, and those respective airlines all make their own deals, buy their own fuel at international markets, have it barged to the port, at which time it gets placed into that tank farm. And then the consortium just manages and knows how many gallons one carrier has stored there and keeps track of the use and the disposition of it. The only revenue side that the airport gets is we do get a fuel flowage fee for every gallon that's pumped through that system, because the airport does own the piping and the infrastructure within the ground from the tank farm to the airport. So the larger piece, as far as impact to the state, as far as less jet fuel being purchased within the state, I don't have any further information for that and how that would impact the revenues for the state.
That's fine. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just thought it was kind of important to get that out there, because it was a big change and most people never saw it. It was an invisible change when the refinery was shut down that people didn't see.
Fair enough. Senator Bishop.
Just to comment on that, part of that reduction from North Pole had to do with the throughput in the pipe. The state didn't have enough, I don't think, enough royalty, RIK, royalty in kind, oil coming through the pipe to service all the refineries in the state. So that's another downside of low flow.
Fair enough. Also, let the record reflect that Senator Keel has joined us. So, all right, everybody good? All right, continue, please.
Next slide. This is just a snapshot. This was our FY20 revenue and costs for the international airports. I won't go into all the detail there, but obviously we brought in about $150 million total on the revenue side. For the operating costs over there, you see just over $120 million. And that's pretty standard, generally about $140 to $150 million budget each year. I will just address the one question that often comes up is, hey, you say you set your rates and fees to cover your costs. Why are the numbers disparate? It's because that operating cost pie chart there on the right does not reflect the airport-funded capital costs that are included in there as well. And that includes both projects that the airport funds solely, and it also includes the match that we put against Federal Aviation Administration funding as well.
Just one quick question for myself. Do you have both Fairbanks and Anchorage here? Do you mingle money from both sides, or do you keep those separate?
Through the chair, I believe that was Senator Keel. Didn't see who it was, but
Senator Wyden's actually, but fine. But continue.
Okay. Yes, that is correct. There is one single International Airport Revenue Fund, IARF, we call it ARF. And yes, revenue from both airports flow into that single fund and is used for the system as a whole. The other piece I meant to mention on this one too, if you look on the left for the revenue, where landing fees makes up about 40% or so of that pie, that will be significant as part of our discussion here on COVID impacts in a couple slides. See, most of the rest of that is considered non-aeronautical revenue that is drastically impacted by passenger activity.
Senator Schauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could you just briefly, if you know the answer, where does the surplus 26.9 go? How is it used and where does it end up?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, are you talking the surplus 26.9 difference between the revenue on the left and the cost on the right?
Yes, sir. I should have been specific. Thanks.
Okay. Yep, that was what I was alluding to related to that reflects airport-funded capital projects during FY20, both individual solely funded by the airports and the match to any grants from the FAA side. So those are capital costs.
Follow-up?
Just to be clear, is it all get used? Do you roll over any? Do anything else with it if you have excess, or do you pretty much eat that up every year? Just trying to figure out, you know, where every – to account for all the dollars is the basic question.
Absolutely. Senator Schauer through the chair. Yes, that money is utilized completely each year. If we have a surplus, then that just rolls over as a surplus to start the new year and allows us to lower our rates and fees that we're setting for that upcoming year. For this year, we were actually about $10 million short due to the dramatic decrease in passenger activity, and we were able to use CARES funds to make up that difference rather than have to back bill the airlines.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess to that specific point, it's use it all or back bill. Do you carry any fund balance at all? And if so, what is that? What sort of fund balance is that?
Sure, Senator Keel, through the chair, we do carry a pretty significant cash balance because we have quite a bit of still outstanding debt, about $350 million of that in the terms of bonds. That requires us to maintain a pretty good-sized balance. And then the other piece is because we are so dependent on international air cargo, and that can change dramatically up or down at any one time, through coordination with our carriers, our signatory carriers, we carry a balance for that as well. We generally average about 1 year of cash on hand, about 365 days worth. So, again, looking at that revenue side, usually around the $130 million or so that we've got available that would carry us forward should we see a big downturn and still allow us to make our debt payments and bondholders and whatnot.
Senator Schauer again.
One more follow-up, and it was generated by the previous question. I just thought of this one. Based on what is being predicted for any kind of a tourist or travel season this summer, obviously very depressed from last year, everybody's aware of that. If you have looked at this or analyzed it or thought about it as an agency, if we have another downturn or it's not as strong, what are your thoughts and issues that you may run into if it's another weak year as far as your cash flow and being able to fund what needs to be funded? In other words, you know, if we have some recovery of this and we have a modest tourist season, will you be okay? If it's depressed again or we go through another wave of something, will it be the kind of thing where you're starting to get into trouble and need help? So just have you looked into the future a little bit and war-gamed what might happen based on various scenarios?
We absolutely have, Senator Schauer, through the chair. So a couple big pieces of that. One, on the initial CARES funding, and I'll elaborate on this a little bit more in the future here, but we did receive $33 million here early summer, specifically allocated to the international airport system. I mentioned that we used $10 million of that to make ourselves whole for FY20, so that does still leave about $22, $23 million remaining that we have not had to use yet that is available to backfill those shortfalls. That said, to this point in time, we had anticipated that cargo would start decreasing somewhat from what it has shown. It hasn't, so that's been good. We've done better on that side. The passenger comeback is about what we've predicted, and that'll be in the next couple slides here as well, what our current activity is and what our projections were. Right now, passenger airlines are scheduled. We have about 90 to 95% of our FY19 seat capability scheduled already for this summer. So airlines seem to be fairly optimistic on the passenger side, even considering the cruise industry. Obviously, they're not fully loading their planes yet, and we'll have to wait and see on what the cruise industry ends up being as well. But we've got quite a bit of back and forth with tourist companies and those on the East Coast as well for a lot of the traveling public that normally goes to Europe or Asia during the summer is now looking for stateside destinations, and Alaska has been pretty high on that list. So we're cautiously optimistic, but yes, we also have that CARES funds to fall back on. And then CRISA amounts just came out as well, and we were allocated another $18 million for the internationals from CRISA too. So we feel pretty confident that we can weather this storm, at least for the next couple of years anyway, based on projected activity levels.
Senator Bishop?
Briefly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bender, on the landing fees, I don't need a – you might have it on the top of your head, you might not. With the chair's permission, get back to the committee, but I'd like to know the percentage on the landing fees, freight versus passenger.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, we can do just a breakdown on who's paying how much. The rate is the same regardless of what type of airplane you fly. It's strictly based on the size of the aircraft. But yes, we can break that down by airline if you'd like.
Yeah, just to give us, it's a curious question for me. I want to. You know, we've heard about the freezer expansion, we've heard about the increase in air freight, and my colleague to the right and I have had some conversations how this seems to be a growing market. It's just a data point to see, you know, for us.
Sure, Senator Bishop, be happy to provide that.
May I make a comment?
Oh, Senator Sherrill.
Just to follow up that in a comment, I think it's important that Alaskans hear this for the record. What I think you're going to see here is what the industry has found generally on the cargo side of things is that they initially thought with new, more efficient aircraft, they would just overfly Anchorage. And so we were predicting for a while there many years ago that we would see a drop off. What has in fact happened is that they've realized that when you fly longer on long haul missions, you tend to burn more gas. So you have to carry more gas to burn more gas, and you can carry less cargo, right? So it's kind of a self-defeating thing. While you can certainly do that for priority cargo, it's tougher to do that because you make less money. When you carry and stop, you can carry a full aircraft and stop in a place like Anchorage with a quick swap of crew and just keep moving and clear customs and other kinds of things. So there are very good benefits as they are learning to doing quick stops in Anchorage, plus cheaper fuel, et cetera. And then continue on. So I say this for a reason. I'm not sure we will see a significant drop-off in cargo coming from Asia to the Americas or vice versa because of how it works for fuel loads and cargo. And so I would anticipate that this will probably stay strong regardless of what tends to happen until they have aircraft that don't need fuel. So anyways, for what it's worth.
Whenever we get to that point. All right, I think we're ready to continue on.
Okay, thank you. Next slide. This is our look back activity report. There are a couple of reasons I put this on here. One, you can, in the past, we've been comparing kind of to the heyday of the 2007-2008 timeframe there before the big downturn. So you see we're back to those levels. The other big piece that this chart shows is this is a breakout between international and domestic cargo and international and domestic passenger flights. The light blue obviously dominates the chart. That is international cargo. The green is the domestic passenger. The purple snow cap there on the mountains is the international passenger, which is almost primarily charter activity in the tourist industry. And then the thin little blue slice along the bottom, that is in-state or domestic cargo. So you see another piece that I would add to what Senator Schauer just shared is that obviously, the international air cargo is the primary revenue driver for our international system, and that's been huge. The huge spike over the last year now because of COVID, I'll just relay, is that about 40% of all air cargo travels generally in the bellies of passenger planes. As those flights have been canceled and turned off for the foreseeable future, that cargo still has to go. Those are your high dollar value, time sensitive type products, and they've just loaded them all on freighters. And obviously we benefit greatly from freighter traffic, as Senator Schauer just shared. So we would expect that to decrease some as international passenger flights start coming back and that belly capacity becomes available, but remains to be seen how much that decreases. Next slide. Certified maximum gross takeoff weight, so you know, the maximum weight of an aircraft, that is what we charge our landing fees by. So really, CMGTW ends up being our best revenue predictor there as we're moving through the year. You can see this just represents the last 5 years. Each line is progressively higher. The green was last year, FY20. So you see toward the last half of the year, that just really took off. And then the magenta blue is the FY21 now activity as well. So again, hanging in there really strong. That has been very beneficial. This number does include passenger activity, but again, passenger activity is way down, and we'll see that on the next slide. This is almost completely driven by cargo. Next slide. This one reflects the passenger activity. So obviously, the opposite story for both of those. What I want to hit on these is, again, about 60% of all airport revenue is related to non-aeronautical activity, driven by passengers. So we're looking at things like concessions within the terminal, rental cars, airport parking, those types of items is a large portion of our revenue. Obviously, if you don't have the passengers, then all of that revenue is gone as well. So that is why we still ended up short on our revenue for FY20, even though we had a very strong cargo market. So that's where the CARES money came in to help make us whole. Next slide. On the capital side, the internationals generally bring in usually around the 20 to 40 million or so per year of capital side, generally from the Airport Improvement Program, FAA. The match for the internationals is right about 12% typically. FY20 was a special case. CARES Act did allow for 100% federal share. So that's where we benefited a little bit from not having to pay that match this last year. FY20 was a little bit down as well because we were just coming off of a real large airport project here, the North-South Runway at Anchorage. So we didn't have a whole lot of big projects anyway, and we deferred what we did have as much as able to help the airlines on the MAP side. That ended up not being as much of a factor. Now you see going into 21 looking like a pretty more normal type year. The supplemental as well, that was additional federal funding made available through a couple of the other acts that Congress has done over the last couple of years. Next slide. It was mentioned earlier, some of the cargo opportunities happened. You know, we've got five big cargo development proposals currently out at Anchorage in various stages. We're expecting Alaska Cargo and Cold Storage to go to construction here this summer there, just across Postmark Drive from the post office. Some huge facilities there, obviously benefiting and trying to take advantage of the big upturn in cargo, and we expect that to continue. The passenger rights, many of you are aware of the special cargo transfer rights that Alaska and Hawaii have had for many years. This year, they also included international passenger transfer rights. So really what that would look like is if a foreign carrier was flying, say, from Asia to Mexico, they'd still fly over top of Alaska as part of the Great Circle, would allow them to land here, transfer passengers that might go on to Canada or might go on to the Caribbean, and allow that to happen, similar to what Reykjavik does in Iceland. They're kind of serving as a hub for a lot of flights coming together, swapping passengers and sending them all back out again. They would still not be allowed to stay in Alaska. Currently, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, has concerns with foreign visas and being able to leave the airport. But it would allow them to transfer at the airport, and that would allow us to see some of that activity then as well. The rest are pretty self-explanatory, except for Fairbanks, and I'll hit a little bit more of unmanned aircraft systems. That's what the UAS stands for, essentially drones, there for Fairbanks here in a little bit. Many exciting things happening there. Next slide.
Got a question from Senator Schauer for you, Carl.
Just a real quick one, sir. On the third one down, seafood export to Asia, my understanding is ASME had looked at this and found it to be kind of cost prohibitive. In other words, the bang for the buck wasn't quite there. And don't get me wrong, I mean, if we find a way to enhance jobs and sell our products, I'm all for it. But and if you don't have any data or don't feel like you're in a position to discuss it, that's certainly fine. But I have a staffer that was really involved in this, and he said it didn't seem to pan out. Is there some new information, reports, analysis, something that we might be able to get from you to talk a little more about that one? Because like all things, we've got to be on guard for, kind of projects that don't pan out. But if there's information telling us that this might be something that's exploded with the growth in Asia and demand, I'm certainly for it. I would just like to see maybe some more information, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Senator Schauer, through the chair. Yes, I can get you some more of that information. Really, most of it's anecdotal. We regularly have Asian marketers and Asian companies coming to us asking for more Alaska seafood. The problem is twofold. One, we have very much gotten in the habit as Alaskans of freezing it, cutting the heads off, et cetera. And Asia wants it live and whole. And so that becomes a challenge that kind of combines with the second piece, and that's getting it from rural Alaska into Anchorage in enough quantities to make it worth the planes landing that are headed back westbound. There's plenty of capacity on the ones headed westbound to load up stuff and market seafood to land here. The problem is getting it to Alaska or to Anchorage. That has been helped a little bit by Alaska Airlines now flying their freighter around. And if we were to see more of that or more from Linden to be able to get the supply to Anchorage, we definitely have a market for that headed west. It is not something of, we're not talking there though, that the airports or the state develop any type of process or seafood company or warehousing or anything like that from a development standpoint. Just keeping an eye on it and continue to try to tie the right people together to take advantage of that opportunity.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
Next slide. Statewide aviation, again, is just what we refer to as our rural system, which is everything except Anchorage and Fairbanks. Here's kind of a breakdown. A big way to think of it, we've got our hubs out there, which a hub just means it's a certificated airport under the FAA. Essentially, anywhere Alaska Airlines or jet aircraft flies are our hubs. And then lots of villages, the spokes around those locations. You all are very well aware of how many are off the road system and the huge lifeline that aviation provides to these communities. And that's never been more apparent than what we've seen over the last year. Next slide. Well, I talked about the internationals being self-sustaining. The rural system is definitely not completely dependent on general funds out there, except for the small pieces of revenue that we are able to generate. You see the cost numbers there. CARES was a huge boon for Alaska on our rural airport system. We got a significant amount of money for that. The intent of those dollars were to offset any lost revenue and additional expenses that our airports incurred due to COVID. And really at our rural airports, since the state doesn't own the terminals, we really did not see any impact at all to revenue at our airports. So it really provided a good chunk of money that we still had to use for aviation expenses, but allowed us to use that instead of general funds and freed up those general funds then for other purposes. And we've discussed those in some other forums. You see the revenue side there, two main pieces. We do rent lease lots there at each of our airports. That's what that leasing revenue is. And then the state collects aviation fuel tax, both on the jet fuel and the aviation gasoline side as well. That flows to the general fund, but that is a designated fund that flows back to the department into the Highways and Aviation Fund to fund aviation. System sustainability is always something we're keeping our eye on close. The climate has caused challenges for us here. We are getting more freeze-thaw events out there, and then more things like erosion and whatnot as well. So always working to try to predict the weather, if you will, figure out the right sand and chemical combinations there to get ahead of those systems, because it's sure a lot easier to be ahead of that and not have to be cleaning ice off the runways there and keep it just be sweeping snow. We also continue to use more and more of our federal AIP dollars to do standard maintenance type activities as well, which is relieve some of the burden on our general funds. The flip side of that is that does pull a little bit of money from our overall capital projects. Cost recovery, I like to keep that one on there just because as these discussions continue statewide on a lot of different areas, aviation is something that we still essentially provide free service to Alaskans at all our rural airports. And that is very different than the standard worldwide where aircraft are paying landing fees, user fees, lots of different options there, but some way to contribute to the service that's being provided. Next slide.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back up to your first bullet, the CARES Act grant for $50 million. It says there for fiscal year 20 and beyond. Do the CARES Act requirements allow us to use that? I just hadn't thought about that. Do they allow us to use that beyond fiscal 20, and are there any strings attached with that if you do something with the money beyond fiscal 20?
Right. No, great question, Senator Schauer, through the chair. The way that money was issued was in a standard FAA grant. Those grants have a four-year period of performance on them. So we have 4 years to utilize those funds. The only caveat is that they had that money specifically has to be used on aviation expenses. It's pretty broad. It can be on any aviation expense, and that's what we've utilized. But that is the only string to it. So what we have used it for is we used it to replace aviation general funds within the region's highways and aviation components for FY20. You see that's about $12 to $14 million. I can't remember the exact number there for FY20. But then that also allowed us currently for 21 and in the proposal for 22 that we're using to be able to use some of those funds again to as kind of a one-time free up for some of those general funds that would have gone to aviation. But yes, four-year period of performance, and that applies to the CRISA funds that were just released as well.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Bender, are we going to be able to use any of that money for AWAS out in these rural villages?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, another good question. FAA has been very specific that these have to be operating expenses, and AWAS construction qualifies as a capital expense. So that is not an option at this time. Now, if we wanted to use some of the state general funds that are freed up by utilizing the CARES for the aviation side, we could steer. It is conceivable we could steer the state general funds to that direction. But again, I think there's lots of priorities competing for those dollars.
Yeah, we'll talk about this offline.
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Please continue.
Next slide. For the rural capital side, again, you kind of see the average look back there. Generally on the rurals, it's around the 130, 140 million or so a year. We generally bring in about 200 total as a state. I mentioned the 40 million or so at the internationals. You see the rural side. Obviously, FY20 was a great year for our rural side. A couple big reasons for that. One, we're always ready to accept those funds, and a lot of states nationwide are not. And so when it gets to the end and they've got a lot of turn back, that gives the FAA a lot of discretionary, and we're always ready in Alaska to capitalize on additional discretionary funds. In addition, the other local sponsors in the state, those non-DOT airports like Juneau, Kenai, Wasilla, some of those, they did not have a large capital year in FY20 as well. The money is allocated by FAA region. So that allowed us, when those locations did not have capital projects, again, we were able to capitalize them on in the rural side. So I wouldn't anticipate that going forward, but it did end up being a great year. The other big bonus this year is that that money was all 100% federal share, so we did not have to pay a state match for that one. So that saved us another about $10, $11 million as well. The bottom there just talks through the match a little bit. I mentioned 12% for the internationals. Generally around the 6% on the rural side. If there is an essential air service contract, that moves it down to a 5%. So pretty good payback on our federal dollars. Next slide. These are just the locations of some of our major projects in 21 and 22. Depending on when those are able to get bid and when contractors are able to get out there and do their mobilization, will determine when that construction actually starts, but those are anticipated. We did not have any real impact to our construction side of the house due to COVID. We were able to put processes in place there, and that was really one of the bright spots for the state this last year, was making sure that construction side moved forward. And we do have plenty of more detail on each of these if anybody has any specific questions that we can provide afterwards. Next slide. I just wanted to finish up with unmanned aircraft systems. This is really a growing bright spot for the state. Really, Alaska is the top one or two states in the country as far as UAS goes. It all started with UAF being selected as one of the test sites, the original seven test sites with the FAA. We have been partnered as the department with UAF all along through this process. Really, how this works is UAF and their integration system, AQUASI is what that stands for. It's the Alaska Center for UAS Integration. They really handle the testing, the integration, the trial pieces. Lots of businesses around the world are constantly contacting UAF, trying to test their systems and come up, bring new things to market. They've got Poker Flats up there. We've started integrating with Fairbanks International as well now for cargo carrying, Part 135 cargo operations, again, all unmanned. So that's really UAF's strong suit. Where DOT has taken the role is more on the statewide program coordinator, if you will. We're working with all the various state departments and agencies, helping them get pilots trained, making sure we're tracking all the systems being used, make sure everybody's following all the rules, all those sorts of things. Working with tribes and communities around the state. Coastal launch program is something that's coming to fruition as well, working with the FAA so that we can conduct commercial operations around the state. So a lot of real neat things, and it's paying huge dividends for all the departments, not just DOT. And that kind of leads us to our next slide, just some examples here.
If just a real quick comment, we are considering bringing in DOT and possibly UAF together sometime here in the next 3 or 4 weeks and doing a overview of this topic specifically, as it does seem to be a interesting one in terms of economic development for the state moving forward. But thank you. Please continue.
Absolutely, and that's exactly why I'm trying to skim pretty close here, because this warrants a much deeper discussion for you all to be aware of. Providing lots of jobs. Safety is pretty obvious, you know, just within DOT, some of the things we're doing. I just brought a system up to Fairbanks today. We're flying Attigan Pass. We're both monitoring snow loads up there and initiating avalanches for keeping the roads open up there. We're doing bridge inspections with drones, where we used to hang with cherry pickers, hang guys out over the bridge and underneath, strapped in. Now that's all being done unmanned. We're flying runway inspections, all those sorts of things, doing tower inspections, all with unmanned aircraft. So you remove the pilot from that piece, the body having to sit there, and safety factor obviously goes up tremendously. I mentioned some of the cargo delivery. The DOT does not do that, but that is something for the future. Cost savings, you know, the one I'll throw out, and let's go to the next slide if y'all don't mind, because the cost savings is a great example. The far right picture there, that's the Cooper Landing bypass. So it's already been cleared, ready for construction to start. We were able to fly up and down that one time with a drone, capture all the terrain, capture the waterways, the hydrology, all those sorts of things with one pass. Contractors able to do material assessments as far as gravel requirements, how much before we'd cleared, we were able to tell how much timber was going to be available, how many loads would be needed to remove that material, all with a single flight. That would have taken many, many days of manned flights to collect the same type of information. The top left corner is Seward Airport. We are now able to fly over a paved surface like that. You can see all the alligator cracks and the failures on that runway. We're able to teach the drones to recognize all of those, and they can come up with a pavement condition index now, pavement reporting, based on that type of information. The middle top is night mute. You see the different colors represented there. That represents still different elevations of the runway. So a carrier comes back and tells us, hey, we're starting to see some humps or bumps or rolls or potholes in a runway. We can send a system out there, do a 10-minute flight up and down the runway, and immediately identify not only where all those things are occurring, but we can immediately calculate how much material is needed to correct those deficiencies as well. Lower left, that's doing the avalanche mitigation. The middle bottom there was when we were watching the rock being blown along the Seward Highway there as well. And then that's the ice road on the Kuskokwim River. Again, you see the different colors. The blue there is representing how that ice is starting to sag due to the heavy activity. So ways you can start predicting already potential fail points and keeping the public safe there before we actually get to that point. So again, this is just a quick cross-section of some of the things happening out there, but we're working closely with all the departments, and everybody's reaping good, lots of good benefits from it. And I believe that's my last slide.
Another question? I just have one, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I think that Transportation Committee would love to go be able to pull the lanyard on the howitzer when you're doing snow removal.
That is fun.
The chairman would like to second that motion. Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to say that there may be a safety concern with some pilots, but not all pilots need to be removed from the equation.
Well, I was going to say I think Senator Schauer was offended by the last portion of that.
A protest official on that one? Okay.
It's also worth noting that while these things are cool, my staff is repping the University of Alaska Southeast colors.
I was trying to say, I know, but it was just ironic, you Senator Keel. I thought it was important to point that out.
All righty. Well, I think we're in good shape here. So, Commissioner Bender, thank you very much for showing up for us today, giving a quick overview. And I believe we are ready to move on to our next area of business from SJR9 from Senator Keel. So this will be our first time hearing the resolution. We want to hear our sponsor's statement, and we do want to take our public testimony, and I do hope that we can move this out of committee today. So, all right. So,
showed up as opposed to the rest of the
committee. Yeah, right. So, Senator Keel, if you could introduce yourself and your staff and take us down to our next area of business here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it very much. For the record, Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of representing Senate District Q, which is the northern half of Southeast Alaska by population. I'm joined by Kathy Schlingheide of my office. And thank you and the committee for hearing Senate Joint Resolution number 9 today. Mr. Chairman, SJR 9 is a call for a lifeline. And that call comes from the COVID pandemic that is wreaking havoc around the world. Unfortunately, Alaska is getting hit with it as hard economically as anyone. And I think the place we're about to see that, we're at risk of seeing that in the most stark and damaging way in our state is the cruise ship season that may not come this summer. In 2019, Mr. Chairman, the state of Alaska saw about 2.25 million visitors. About 1.3 million of those folks came to or left Alaska on a large cruise ship. All in, Mr. Chairman, the tourism sector was responsible for roughly $4 billion in economic activity in our state. And the resolution you'll see in the whereas clauses breaks out some of that economic activity in terms of payroll, in terms of visitor direct spend. I won't go through those numbers. The key thing that prompted SJR9, Mr. Chairman, is that in 2020, those numbers dropped perilously close to zero. Small and medium-sized Alaska businesses closed or are closing. A few are holding on. Many are holding on with a tremendous amount of federal help. The Payroll Protection Program, the Economic Injury Disaster Loans, CARES grants through the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community Economic Development. When you put all those things together, they're enough for some of our small business owners to max out their credit cards, in many cases mortgage their homes, to try and hold on through the last season when the visitors they make their living serving didn't come. Their employees, by and large, didn't get hired this last year. Many are trying to make it through on pandemic unemployment assistance and keep body and soul together, keep the rent paid or the mortgage. Mr. Chairman, if we don't have a tourist season of any significance in 2021, there aren't going to be small and medium-sized Alaska-owned businesses to apply for federal assistance this year. They won't be able to make it. The Alaskans who work in those seasonal jobs, the Alaskans who own those businesses, will be in the most dire of straits. So SJR 9 calls on our congressional delegation, calls on the executive branch and the federal government to take time-limited but necessary steps to make it possible for us to have a large cruise ship season in 2021. Rather than spend a lot of the committee's time on the specific laws that are at issue, one of them is mentioned. There are other complexities and details. Mr. Chairman, in drafting the resolution, I worked with members of our congressional delegation and their staff to ask them what approach they'd like us to take. They requested that we send a resolution, but that we not tie their hands to any one avenue of providing the help Alaskans need so that the ships have a chance to come. So this resolution simply calls on the federal government to help us out, to give us a shot at having the single largest source of tourism business in Alaska come this summer. I think it's important here to point out a couple of things that this resolution is not. Mr. Chairman, this resolution is not a call for any permanent changes to our federal law. It's not a call to make lasting changes in some of the federal rules that are designed to protect American steel or American shipbuilding, protect U.S. jobs. It is a call for a one-season lifeline. It is also, Mr. Chairman, not, as unfortunately a few folks have commented in the last day or two, it is not an unfettered open door for any unlimited number of cruise ship passengers permanently into the future. Various communities in our state have all kinds of issues they're working on in terms of planning economic activity, planning community facilities, planning to mitigate impacts that businesses have on local folks, right? Benefits sometimes come with costs. Nothing, Mr. Chairman, in SJR 9 tries to tip the scales there. This is not, and I need to emphasize this, this is not a call for unfettered growth forever and ever. This is limited to the 2021 season and the economic disaster we potentially face. And finally, importantly, Mr. Chairman, this is not a call to ignore COVID safety. The United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is the gold standard in controlling and responding to disease outbreaks. The CDC put out a conditional sale order in October of 2020 that laid out a rigorous process that large cruise lines would need to meet before they'd be allowed to sail. Mr. Chairman, if I didn't think those standards protected Alaskans, I would not have brought you this resolution. I believe the CDC and the standards they have put forth will allow us to have the economic activity and the life, health, safety that we need while keeping Alaskans employed and Alaskan businesses opened if we can get there this year. With that, Mr. Chairman, I commend the resolution to the committee, and I'm happy to take any questions.
We have any questions?
I have a comment.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you would indulge me for a moment, I feel I would be remiss if I did not make this point to it. Senator Keel, I appreciate the resolution, and I certainly support trying to get our business back because many of the small business owners you speak about, this was not their fault. They didn't ask for this. This was not something they planned for, and many of them have already gone out of business. It certainly has happened in my district, and I even have two ports, so you wonder why that guy from the MATSU is always wondering, well, I have two ports in my district. But my concern is in that this goes to the larger issue of we have driven a spike of fear so far into the hearts of people with COVID and our response to it that we, even when you look at the cruise ships, many people are not even booking them. I've asked the same questions of them. And so wanting to get them here and open it up so that we can get the industry, that's great. But as I've talked to a few people that are more familiar with the industry, they're just not getting the booking numbers anyways. Why? Because people are scared to death. So what I'm trying to say is that we are, in some instances, we have caused this ourselves because we have propagated the concern and response to COVID so much that many people aren't even going to travel if they can travel, if we are able to open this up. And believe me, we need it. And when you consider what's happened from the administration perspective of already putting things on hold that are important to the economics of this state, you know, development of our oil fields and gas, mining and other things, logging, that would be important to industry and jobs as well. We're going to continue to struggle in this state. So this is important, and I agree with you. We want to open it up. My broader point of saying this is that if we continue with this idea that so many people are running scared from COVID, and I agree with you on the concepts of CDC, of being the gold standard and being able to do it safely. I've said this all along. We can safely operate and keep our economy open, and we can protect the vulnerable. But we have made, and who cruises? They typically are the ones that are the more vulnerable category, being older. That's usually the category we're talking about. So we have set ourselves up here in a way to fail with what has happened. And this is nationwide, not necessarily us. But I want people to hear this because I think it's important that this goes to the heart of the matter. We could be operating this entire time, but we shut ourselves down. And I don't necessarily mean Alaska. I mean nationally. And Canada's doing it to itself, and that's kind of our problem in other countries. And believe me, I see it because I travel all over the world. I've seen it for a year now. So what I'm asking for with something like this is that people need to understand we need to get away from the fear of this and allow us to operate. Let the economy open. Get people back in the cruise ships. Don't run in fear from something that we can protect the vulnerable and vaccines and other things that are coming. It's a broader part of this entire picture. This is just one piece of the puzzle, and I acknowledge that. But I want people to understand that it's much broader than just cruise ships coming through here and bringing us, hopefully, our 1.2 million through the southeast and the broader picture. If we don't move past this to open everything up and protect the vulnerable and get people back to work, we're going to be in trouble anyways, and our state's already struggling. This is just one piece of that puzzle. So I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, the indulgence in that because I do agree that we need to ask for this, but it's a broader problem that people need to understand. We need to get back to work, and we need to move past this, and we can do it safely with those things. So it's just a broader plea, I guess, for me to everybody. Let's move on and open it up, but do the right thing. So thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chair. I want to encourage us to move forward, and I feel like we're still stuck for a lot of people, and I am concerned, Senator Keel, that even if we do this, we're not going to see the ships come through because people are still afraid. So anyways, thank you, Mr. Chair, for that.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Keel.
If I may, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the discussion, and I worry that my passion for this issue, I may have painted only a dark picture. Senator Schauer is absolutely correct, Mr. Chairman, that there is great cause for hope. There are two vaccines being rolled out in great numbers. There are additional vaccine candidates out there seeking their emergency use authorizations, and the initial numbers look very good. I believe that tremendous increases are coming in the number of Americans who are vaccinated, who will feel safe to travel, who will be able to travel safely without carrying risk to anybody else. Combine that with the protocols for the ships. Combine that with safety measures in our communities. I think that there's great possibility for a return to economic activity with safety. And that, I think, is maybe something I lost focus on in introducing the bill to you. But thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Schauer is correct. We've got a lot of cause for hope.
All right. Any other discussion up here? All right. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and open public testimony on SJR. So we've got quite a few people online. So I believe we're going to start with Mayor Weldon of Juneau. If you are ready to go, if you could, let's see if I'm doing this right. There we go. If you could go ahead and identify yourself for the record and present your testimony. Alex?
Make sure he's not on mute.
Whoop.
Let me make sure he's on the line.
Not online. Oh, Mayor's not online anymore. Okay. In that case, we will go to Paula Terrell of Juneau. If you could simply identify yourself and then give your testimony, please. Thank you.
Did you want me to testify? This is Paula.
Yes, please.
Okay. Excuse me. My name's Paula Terrell, and I'm testifying because I have some concerns relating to SJR 9. To be completely transparent about this, I've been a member of Juneau's Visitor Industry Task Force, which dealt almost exclusively with the cruise ship industry. But I am, in this case, testifying on SJR 9 as an individual. This resolution supports a waiver or exemption from provisions of the Passenger Vessel Services Act, specifically from a requirement that foreign flag vessels need to stop in a non-USA port. In our case, that's Canada, which has closed its port until 2022. I really understand and support the sponsor's attempt to provide relief to local businesses that have suffered real economic hardships from this last cruise ship season. And at the same time, I believe that a waiver or exemption isn't the solution and would open a Pandora's box. Excuse my voice. Without a waiver, foreign flag cruise ships would be able to travel in international waters, in other words, 12 miles offshore, and directly access Southeast Alaska. We have no idea how many large cruise ships would take advantage of this opportunity, but this really flies in the face of many, such as myself, who wish to see limits on the number of cruise ships and passengers. As it is, I know of only one large cruise ship, it's Norwegian Cruise Lines, I believe, that is not foreign flag. The others choose to be foreign flag because they don't pay certain taxes and perhaps there are other financial costs were they to be U.S. ships. To me, this waiver would be just one more gift that we would be providing to them. It's true, there are some very strict CDC guidelines that would potentially minimize the cruise ship traffic. For example, there has to be a port agreement between the cruise ship operator and the port authority to determine the number of cruise ships in a single port. I'm not so sure that that offers us very much assurance. So I really would say that for me, I would like to see the legislature find other options to having this kind of a waiver. There are a couple of details that I just would like to direct to the committee. SJR 9 is directed to the Congress as the entity that would approve a waiver. And that was my impression as well. However, under a 2019 document from the Department of Homeland Security, which I received, it states that a PVSA waiver can only be granted by the Secretary of Homeland Security. So supposedly, if it's directed to Congress, that's not the entity that would approve a waiver. In addition, the PVSA can only be waived if it is, and I'm quoting, necessary in the interest of national security. This is the same language as is found in the Jones Act, which deals with goods and services. However, I see no national security issues with the PVSA, which applies to passengers. So those are my comments, and I would hope that the legislature and the state could seek other options for supporting our local businesses other than this waiver. Thank you for hearing.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Terrell. We're going to go ahead and move to Ms. Kimberly Metcalf next. If you could please state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Myers and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Metcalf, and I'm a Juneau resident. I'm speaking today to oppose passage of Senate Joint Resolution 9. I rarely disagree with the resolution sponsor, my senator, Senator Jesse Keel, but as Senator Keel knows, I've long been concerned with the issues related to the foreign flagged cruise ship industry. I'm opposed to exempting the industry from the provisions of the Passenger Vessel Services Act that requires a stop at a Canadian or other foreign port. Last month, a spokesperson for Transport Canada stated that Canada has decided to extend the ban on cruise ships until February 28, 2022 because, and I quote, cruise vessels in Canadian waters pose a risk to our healthcare systems. The government of Canada will continue to evaluate the situation and make changes as necessary to ensure the health and safety of all Canadians. Should the COVID-19 pandemic sufficiently improve to allow the resumption of these activities, the Minister of Transport has the ability to rescind the interim orders, end of quote. So this ban on cruise ships stopping at Canadian ports hurts not just Alaskan ports of call, but the ports of Vancouver and Victoria, BC. Those cities are losing millions of dollars in revenue, but the Canadian government has decided that the health and safety of their people comes first. I want to state that I understand the financial burden that the ban on cruises puts on Southeast Alaska. I have family members who've been hard hit financially by the lack of a cruise season in 2020 and who are looking forward to the resumption of cruises this year. Fortunately, they've been helped by our federal government through the CARES Act and the funds it provides through the Paycheck Protection Program and extended unemployment insurance. I must point out that the foreign flagged cruise industry pays nothing in U.S. taxes, so they've contributed nothing to the financial bailout of Alaskans or other Americans who've been harmed financially by the lack of a cruise season. I believe that in spite of the financial hardships experienced because of the lack of the cruise season, we're also faced with an opportunity to re-examine our relationship with the cruise industry. Our communities face numerous problems connected with the explosive growth of the industry: overcrowding, dangerous traffic bottlenecks, air and water pollution, crowded docking, harassment of whales and other wildlife, and helicopter noise. We have an opportunity over the coming year to try and resolve the issues we face. Issue number one, however, is the health and safety of Alaskans. Large-scale cruising should not resume until the pandemic is officially over. Our communities are small and vulnerable. We do not have the medical or emergency services capacity to deal with outbreaks. The future is still very unclear when it comes to dealing with variants, and we don't know how long vaccines are effective. So I urge the committee to follow Canada's lead and put the health and safety of our communities first. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Metcalf. We're going to move on to Ray Preston of Juneau. And just in the interest of time, if testifiers could please just keep things relatively short so we don't have to do an official time limit. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Preston. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Ray Preston. I'm a resident of Juneau. I'm testifying solely on behalf of myself. In my view, Senate Joint Resolution Number 9 is a misguided, knee-jerk response to the Canadian ban of cruise ships from its waters. I believe that its intended audience, the United States Congress, will also see it as a knee-jerk thing done out of desperation. It is misguided because it pretends there is no pandemic. It ignores the risks. There is a reason that the Canadians issued their ban. Their goal is to protect Canadian citizens. The goal of this resolution, on the other hand, is that we should all carry on as though the pandemic does not exist. Never mind the pandemic. Never mind the risks. We want those ships. We want those passengers. And we want the revenue that those ships represent. The resolution pretends that the world has not changed. The proposed resolution also badly misrepresents the CDC guidance regarding cruise ships. I went to the CDC website. This is what I found. And I want to quote, "Key points for cruise ship travelers. CDC recommends that all people avoid travel on cruise ships, including river cruises, worldwide, because the risk of COVID-19 on cruise ships is very high. It is especially important that people with increased risk of severe illness avoid travel on cruise ships, including river cruises. Cruise passengers are at increased risk of person-to-person spread of infectious diseases, including COVID-19. And outbreaks of COVID-19 have been reported on cruise ships. I assume that you will adopt this resolution, but I doubt that it is going anywhere. I hope not. It doesn't deserve to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Preston. Moving on to Carla Hart of Juneau. Could you please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, please?
Thank you. My name is Carla Hart, and I am also in Juneau, Alaska, and testifying as a private citizen. I have decades of experience in and around the tourism business, including 10 years of having my own tourism businesses. I appreciate the pressure that's being felt to pass this resolution and do something. I have two big concerns with the resolution. The first is that it falls to a victim to a common false equivalency that's expressed often in Alaska. Tourism does not equal cruise tourism. The cruise industry has the biggest voice, the most visitors, and the most visible impacts in the Alaska tourism industry. The whereas statements in SJR 9 perpetuate an incomplete and muddled picture of the economic impact of the industry by lumping cruise and other visitors together. For example, from the 2016 Alaska Visitor Statistics Program, which is the most recent I could find, there was $2 billion in total in-state spending, and cruise passengers accounted for one-third of that total spending, not the full amount. And so the $2.2 billion that's attributed in a muddled way to the cruise industry is not accurate, and we should be more honest in supporting our diverse tourism economy and not putting everything into the cruise industry. And secondly, I have serious concerns about the final further resolve, page 2, line 26. This statement, as it's written, basically says it's a get-out-of-free card for the cruise industry to not have any fine or enforcement against them while the Canadian ports are closed to cruise ships. I expect that the sponsor's intent was relating to enforcement of the Passenger Vessel Services Act, but as I read this, it does not say that, and it basically says if the Canadian ports are closed to cruise ships, we're asking to not have any of the other environmental and all of the regulation safety that they are under. So if you are to do anything with this, I urge that you amend it first so that you don't give them a get-out-of-free card, because they have a long history of environmental violations and would likely take this as get-out-of-jail-free card. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hart. We'll be moving on to Susan Schrader of Juneau. If you could please identify yourself with the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Myers and committee members. My name is Dr. Susan Schrader. I have lived in Juneau for the past 30 years, and I'm testifying today on behalf of myself. The City and Borough of Juneau's Assembly and staff have done a masterful job of dealing with the COVID pandemic. I myself am now fully vaccinated, and I welcome the day when all Juneau residents can be vaccinated. I'm acutely aware that locally owned businesses that cater to cruise ship passengers have been severely hurt during the pandemic, as have many other businesses in Juneau. Until all Juneau residents who want vaccines can receive them, our local economy will not fully recover from what has been a very long ordeal for all of us. Senator Keel's sponsor statement for SJ9, and he also spoke to it today, cites that the CDC has published stringent COVID safety protocols for responsible cruising in American waters. And while I very much trust the CDC, I do not trust the foreign-flagged cruise industry to follow those protocols, or any U.S. law, for that matter. We know COVID tests are not perfect. We hear reports from around the world of cruise ship passengers who test negative before the cruise departs, and then positive when tested a few days later while the cruise is underway. I would suggest to the committee, and specifically to Senator Schauer, that we can actually look upon the cruise ships as nothing more than huge floating assisted living facilities with passengers congregating in bars, restaurants, and nightclubs over the course of a week or more. What better way to become infected and spread the virus to the residents in the ship's ports of call, such as Juneau, in the ship's own home ports, and in the home communities the infected guests return to? The CDC conditional sail order of October 30th, 2020, requires cruise ship operators to obtain approval from each port community in which the ship will stop. In my view, that approval must be based on the best science available and, most importantly, reflect the local residents' will. I strongly urge the Alaska legislators to do what you can to ensure that port communities have the resources to develop those COVID protocols that fully protect their residents from any visitors. For our state and federal governments to assist these foreign corporations selling leisure travel to bypass our laws that will likely do nothing to shorten the COVID pandemic. And for that reason alone, SJR 9 is badly misguided. Thank you.
Senator Bishop?
Can we have a brief at ease?
Yeah, brief at ease. Going back on the record, thank you all for attending. Seeing no other business before the committee, that will conclude our meeting for today. Next meeting is next Tuesday, February 23rd, also at 1:30 p.m. We will be hearing an overview on the Alaska Marine Highway System from DOT. With that, we are adjourned at 3:04 p.m. Thank you.